Hello, Time Sliders. You're listening to Time is Sliding. And I'm Rob Bayliss. Podcasting about change. Now let's slide on. Welcome to episode 2 of Time is Sliding. Each month I'm exploring aspects of the world that are changing over the precious time that is slippery sliding away. I interview ordinary and extraordinary people about changes in themselves, society and the environment on which we all depend. Episode 1 included part of a discussion I recorded exactly 3 months before my subject experienced the biggest change that everyone will experience, the end of life. Episode 2 features more of that discussion, partly because it's the last recording I have of my brother Phil, and partly because I think it deserves a wider audience. Despite the fact that Phil's health was deteriorating because of an aggressive cancer, he takes us backwards and forwards through time with his unique dry humour. I've called this episode Change in Fantasy, Religion and Death. Fiction, especially science fiction, along with Christianity, were important to Phil, so they provide the vehicle for this episode to explore change. In episode 1, I described the circumstances of the recording and gave a brief biography of Phil. I won't repeat all of that, as you can catch up on episode 1 if you haven't already heard it. But to recap, we chatted in Phil's house, socially distanced, not because of COVID-19, but because he was having chemotherapy and so his immune system was compromised. Let's now slide on to the discussion itself. We start with me asking Phil about a time in the past that he would like to visit. Although this fantasy seems like a departure from an exploration of change through Phil's eyes, his response shines a light on huge changes in the world and in his own life.
What part of the past or time in the past would you like to go and visit?
Oh, right. That's an interesting question. Might be interesting going back to have a good old chat with myself as a teenager.
What would you say to that teenager?
Hi. You won't believe who I am. Trouble is, if you give them advice, they'd ignore it. If we're just going to visit, the Second World War would be okay, but I don't want to get killed because that would kind of be a problem in sort of time paradoxes.
Mm. So why would you want to go back to the Second World War?
Well, there was a lot going on. You got Spitfire pilots and all that glamour.
So it's the glamour of it that you'd like?
Yes, I think so. They were all a bit glamorous, wasn't it? Particularly in the RAF. But, I mean, that's...
how it's portrayed, isn't it?
Really? How it's portrayed, yeah. Mm. The reality of it would have been horrendous.
People flying off to their death, basically. And, of course, causing a lot of death.
I don't think they thought that they were in the face of death. Yeah. The pilots who got in the planes, they just did it.
Yes, I think there's certainly an element of that. I mean, I've read The Last Torpedo Flyer by Arthur Aldridge. And he just seemed to have no nerves in his body at all. And you're just thinking, and he would not, I think he would not class himself as brave. He would just class himself as just doing what he had to do.
That's it, yeah.
Reading about what he's doing and you're thinking, could I even contemplate that? And, you know, we watched the film Midway last night. And, you know, these bombers were going in to bomb the Japanese aircraft carriers. And, you know, it was pretty bad stuff. But then all these Japanese people were shooting back at them. You just got tracers and everything flying past the planes, and you're just thinking any one of those plus any of the bullets in between would just put an end to the, you know, anybody's life. And they were just doing it anyway. Midway is based on a true story. So we were thinking, you know, a lot of that is probably exactly as it was. It's terrible stuff, really. But then when you think about what they were fighting for, when you were finally found out, you're thinking, why would you not? We got one chap from church who said he'd never forgive the Germans. He says, you know, you can all forgive the Germans if you like. But I was trained to kill the bastards all through the war. I'll never forget that. And when you see some of these sort of real life films, you can say, right, well, you can sort of distance yourself from it and say, you know, this is the past. And then you can also see exactly where someone had to live through it and witness some of those events would find it so deeply changing that they could never change back.
It's no surprise that there have been huge changes in society in the 7 decades since the 1940s. But reflecting on them can help us be grateful for some of the better aspects of the 2020s. For example, inequalities in women's experiences are still present in society, but feminism has made great strides towards a fairer society over those 7 decades. The same can be said about the enormous personal changes that many of us go through in our lifetimes. Like Phil, the person I was in my teenage years would barely recognise the person I am now. Although there's always a war going on somewhere in the world, the 2020s are relatively peaceful compared with the 1940s. Some credit for this must go to the formation of the United Nations in 1945, out of a desire for peace and the avoidance of another world war. Similar reasons stimulated the evolution of what ultimately became the European Union. However, I think it's important to repeat Phil's point that attitudes such as hatred of another nationality still exist and can be deeply ingrained due to a lived experience in the past. This seems subtly different to racism, but it's certainly prejudice against a group of people based on generalisations, ignorance, and depersonalising the other. It's sad that some people find it impossible to change themselves to live in the present and not the past. I'll never forget a discussion I had with Professor Nguyen Van Hung during a work-related visit to him in Vietnam in 1995. He'd lived through extremely heavy bombing of Hanoi by the USA during the Vietnam War. He'd lost relatives in that war too. I asked him how he felt about that 20 years on. Unlike the person Phil talked about, my professor friend said that he bore no grudges and that the past was not important. To him, good relations with the USA and US citizens was much more important. There are many who would benefit from adopting that perspective. Recently, I've been wading through The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. The book's central message is that only the present moment is real and that both the past and future are illusions. Racism and other prejudices would surely die if that message could be accepted widely. We're still in the past with the next clip, but it's a hilarious turn in the conversation, thanks to our mother. Some listeners might wonder why Phil refers to Mom and not Mum in the clip. You might also have noticed references to Mom in episode 1. Phil would sometimes rib me for saying Mom and not putting a U between the two M's. The reason for these different pronunciations is that one of our parents came from the Black Country in the West Midlands of England and the other from nearby in Birmingham. Mothers are known as Mom in both places. It's not an Americanization. By the time Phil was born 6 years after me, our family had moved away from the West Midlands and he was more exposed than I had been to mothers being called Mum. Later on, it was probably reinforced after meeting and marrying a Lancashire person. The fact that Phil says Mom in this clip is probably because of a natural tendency we all have to adjust, dare I say change, vocabulary according to who is listening. During the conversation, Phil mentions a chat via Zoom with his singing teacher and his singing partner. They were talking about what music, books and luxuries they would want to take to a desert island if castaways. British listeners will recognise this as following the format of a long-running British radio programme, Desert Island Discs.
Yeah, well, I know where I get my imagination from. I was just thinking about that. I get it from Mum, don't I?
You do.
Making up stories just... mine are just more ridiculous.
I used to open the book to read him a story, and if I didn't like the ending, I used to make up or say further instalments tomorrow night.
They never came.
My goodness.
Yeah.
So is that why Narnia finished with a car chase? It did sound a bit incongruous. There's King Peter in a Lamborghini.
This is all on the theme of change.
You should enjoy it anyway.
Well, yeah, it's quite exciting. I chose them as my Desert Island Disc booklet today. Mm-hmm. I said I'd go for an omnibus edition of the Narnia stories. And a solar-powered digital self-updating photo frame. Which I got away with.
Your compare for Desert Island Discs was quite relaxed by the sound of things.
It would be the most hilarious programme going.
Well, they weren't. They were a bit surprised by my second piece of music.
Oh, what was that?
Be careful with that axe, Eugene. Then as children ran in and said, "Are you all right?" They did as well.
Didn't they?
Yeah. What was that? Lex was all right.
The version of Careful With That Axe, Eugene, that Phil chose, is a live version on Pink Floyd's 1969 album, Umma Gumma. Over nearly 9 minutes, it builds up from a quiet, serene, but eerie start to a dramatic crescendo of human and then guitar screaming, eventually ending as eerily as it started. The fact that Phil chose it is partly down to me, because I introduced it to him. It's also another indication from Phil of how musical taste may not change significantly compared with other things. I talked about this in episode 1. Phil's other choice of Desert Island disc, Allegri's Miserere, also cropped up in episode 1. I'm not sure I was being fair to Phil when I asked him to look to the future in the next clip. He was uncomfortable to start with, for obvious reasons, but he soon relaxed as we moved on to a brief discussion about tackling climate change.
So, moving from the past to the future, mm-hmm. Where in the future would you like to go? And what do you think it'll be like in sort of 2050, for example?
Where in the future would I like to go?
Oh.
Not sure. Probably, yeah, not sure about the future. You know, part of me says, you know, it might be nice to jump forward 6 months. Part of me says, might be nice to jump forward a century. Because my own future is so uncertain, it's difficult to assess that objectively. What do I think we'll be like in 2050?
Mm.
Warm.
You don't think humanity will sort out climate change?
Well, I think it probably will, eventually. But
in time?
I think we'll all get a bit warm first. I think other technologies will present themselves. I think there'll be emergent things that happen, because even because of COVID-19, all working at home, that sort of thing. But I'm not totally sure whether that's good or bad for the climate.
Well, working at home is an interesting one, because I think people will attend fewer meetings physically.
That's got to be good.
Using Zoom or whatever is a lot less energy intensive than physical meetings.
Yeah.
So I think that's definitely going to be a change. Although I think people will slip back into physical meetings as well. But not so many, I think.
No, and well, it will change in hospitals as well. I mean, you've got doctors, you can shove them in a cupboard now with a computer screen. And they can do a whole outpatient clinic on the video. And you're thinking, well, that saved an awful lot of... You've now got a load of real estate in the hospital that you're not using for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a load of patients and ambulances and stuff not going hither and thither.
Yeah.
So that's got to be a good thing.
Mm.
It is interesting that Phil's got a phone consultation on Thursday, and you would never have had a phone consultation in this situation prior to COVID-19, but is there anything that needs to be face-to-face? Probably not. So therefore, that's something that's come in that will be valuable to happen again in the future. Some, I think, you do need to see face-to-face, but there are others that no.
Well, I suppose a physical examination, there is no substitute at the moment, is there?
No, absolutely not.
But when it's just talk?
Yes, exactly. But it would never have been even considered. You would have been given a physical appointment and you would have gone in for it. And then you would have sat and chatted and then you'd have come away.
My eyes well up each time I hear Phil considering a future just 6 months after our discussion, and him not being able to imagine it. As he said, his own future was so uncertain at that time. The certainty came 3 months later, and I can't help wondering, in vain, if Phil might have been able to change his route, or even his timetable, had he been able to project his mind forward 6 months. Creative visualization is a technique through which a person uses their imagination to form vivid mental images of what they want their future to be. It can change emotions as well as make the desired future more certain to happen. Okay, Phil was very ill, and my musing won't bring him back. But I do feel that the mind can help overcome many physical challenges, even though I think Eckhart Tolle might argue with that. I grew up with the phrase, mind over matter. There's plenty of information elsewhere about creative visualization, so I'll include a link to a psychology article about it in the episode notes. Phil seemed optimistic that new technology and practices would reverse the climate crisis after it gets worse. Over the last 30 years, many politicians have expressed faith in technological fixes being available in the future when they don't want to take immediate action. I don't think Phil was in that same mindset, and I hope that the United States Special Presidential Envoy for Climate John Kerry isn't either, despite what he told the BBC in May 2021. In an interview with Andrew Marr, he said, "I'm told by scientists that 50% of the reductions we have to make to get to net zero emissions by 2050 or 2045 are going to come from technologies we don't yet have." Well, I don't know, this is me speaking now, I don't know which scientists Mr. Kerry has been listening to, but I join with others in arguing that we already have the technologies, but it's their deployment that needs to be accelerated, along with people making changes in their diets and modes of travel. I have to say that I'm less optimistic than Phil about adequate action being taken to mitigate climate change before it's too late. Pledges made and not made by governments in preparation for the COP26 climate change conference in Glasgow in November 2021 show that they're not treating climate change as the emergency that it is. For a start, pledges don't necessarily lead to action that will deliver on those pledges. But even if the pledges and targets made by governments by April 2021 are actually met, the Climate Action Tracker estimates that they would result in global average temperature rising 2.4 degrees centigrade above what it was before the Industrial Revolution. That may not seem much, but it's still dangerously high compared with the 1.5 degree safety threshold that almost all climate scientists have agreed on as okay-ish. We are now in the most critical decade for action, with at least 50% of greenhouse gas emissions needing to be cut by 2030 to have a chance of stopping climate change escalating out of human control. Some impacts of climate change are perilously close to tipping points, past which there will be nothing that can be done to stop their consequences. Some tipping points have already been passed. If you haven't already watched the Netflix documentary Breaking Boundaries, I challenge you to watch it, and watch it with a child, or at least someone under 30, if that's not you already. The film graphically explains climate change and other ecological tipping points, along with their current status. If that's not enough, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on the 9th of August that the report published by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change on that day is a code red for humanity. I'll repeat that. A code red for humanity. To have a good quality of life in the future, a code red means that everyone will have to make some hefty changes in what they do. Another aspect of the COP26 conference in Glasgow chimes with the discussion that Phil, his wife Jane and I had about attending meetings and medical appointments. The Polish National Centre for Emissions Management has calculated that the average greenhouse gas emissions caused by a person attending a 12-day international conference like COP26 would be 2,300 kilograms. That's 2.3 tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalents, and about the same as each of around 30,000 delegates having a return scheduled airline flight from Jakarta, capital of Indonesia, to Glasgow. It's also about the same as the carbon dioxide emissions of the average Indonesian for a whole year. A similar conference undertaken online, on the other hand, would result in emissions averaging 36 kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalents per person. That's less than 2% of the average for a physical conference, and includes emissions associated with home, gas and electricity consumption, computer manufacture, networks and data centre usage. That certainly makes me question the sense in having a fully physical climate change conference, even though it's clear that some face mask to face mask negotiations are likely to be essential. Maybe this is the point where I ask you, listener, to give me your thoughts on what life will be like in 2050. What will have changed to deliver a livable future for the generations that follow you and me? You could put this as part of a review of the podcast, along with a rating in your chosen podcast platform. Alternatively, please share your thoughts via Twitter and copy to @timeissliding. That's all one word, with the T and the second S as capitals. It's in the episode notes too. Let's move to the next clip now. In it, I asked Phil to talk about his interest in science fiction and what changes the genre has predicted. Typically Phil, he started with a joke and made out that I didn't get it.
Science fiction. That's an area that you used to be into. I don't know whether you still are.
Yeah, I still like science fiction.
What science fiction do you think has actually happened?
A lot of it, really. I've been reading stuff from the sort of 17th century, so a lot of it's now happened.
So it was 17th century science fiction?
Yeah, I think I just made that up.
Sorry. I got it.
Thanks, darling.
You're welcome.
Well, if you think about it, Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, what's strange about a submarine being able to be under the sea for a long time these days? We've got a lot of the Asimov stuff, and certain bits of it, and he even talks about sort of global warming and how we get over that with, public transport and... So there's some interesting stuff, and you can see how people get to where they get to. I've always liked Asimov as probably my mainstay of science fiction. But sometimes people like Frank Herbert, they put a little twist on. And he's got planets called We Made It and things like that. Mm. And so that's kind of fun. And again, Frank Herbert, it was Dune and Dune Messiah were my favourite books of that.
I remember you writing those.
Which is particularly sort of a religious thing, the way that he sort of, how everything works around religion. So it was an interesting, he went off the boil in the end. Well, he died, actually. But
shouldn't laugh, but going off the boil.
Yeah, well, I suppose.
Going off the boil with a vengeance.
Going off the boil big time, really. So, yes, he died in the end, which was probably the safest for all of us, because the stories were getting a little bit tenuous. Mm. But the first two were good. I think I read the first five, and I was thinking, what's all this about? God Emperor of Dune and Dune Messiah. Oh, no, Dune Messiah was the second book. Children of Dune. June, 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 and June. There was a sort of quartet of female singers. Mm. That sort of thing. So you're just thinking it was all... And the books get longer and longer as you get through the series as well. I've never really understood that. But the... so I got a bit fed up with those. But, I really liked the Asimov. And so I reread last year or the year before all of the Asimov robot stories, which includes all the Foundation trilogy, a series in something like six parts. And if you read it in the chronological order as opposed to the order they were written, it kind of brings the whole of the universe together. And that was good. It's good to see how things changed over time. And how things were incorporated and things stopped happening, and it was good.
What were the key changes in it?
Well, it was all about something called psychohistory. So it kind of ties in with, you have a chat to Josh about psychology. And psychohistory was the ability to predict the behaviour of populations based upon previous indices. So the whole point about Foundation and the robot series was to ensure the survival of mankind. Whereas you could see that mankind was not going to survive if left to his own devices. So this chap called Harry Seldon, who invented psychohistory, and you hear about it from Josh about some of the things he talks about, sort of predictive psychology and things like that. You think, right, well, he arranged things so that although at the time it may not seem that the best thing had happened, ultimately it did. And civilization survived. I've forgotten how long they had to get through, something like 3 millennia or something, because that was the danger point. And you just think about global warming and some of those things, and the fact that global warming could be pretty bad for us. And there's probably ways of getting around that, which probably not particularly acceptable to a lot of people. But, it's interesting.
What ways of getting around of it?
I can't think. I remember his transport thing. He had belt drives. So basically there was no traffic. He just had these big belts. And he'd start at the bottom and get onto this slow belt. And then you get onto a faster belt and a faster belt until you'd be leaning into the wind at 70 miles an hour on the fastest belt.
Mm.
And then you had to basically hop yourself off again so that you could get off where you wanted to get off. And that's how transport happened around the city and everything. These belt drives. And that was public transport. Interesting thought.
And that was a solution to climate change, was it?
No, that was just the way they arranged to get round. They're not books about climate change,
right?
So so it's just the way they got around the city, and you look at these travelators, and that's exactly what they do. Apart from the fact that you don't have a travelator next to another travelator, but you can jump on a travelator and just pretend you're running. So a number of these things have sort of come in. I don't even know where. So he was writing these things in the 1940s and 1950s. They wouldn't even have escalators in those days. It's an own travelators.
It's interesting. I would have thought escalators have been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in America more than here.
I don't know. You'd have to look it up. When did escalators first arrive anywhere? Actually, yes, they're quite old, aren't they? In the London Underground.
Yes, they have wooden threads.
Because that was one of the problems. Mm. Because there was the fire in King Cross? Someone had thrown a cigarette and it set fire to the escalator.
Is that what caused it?
So we must have had escalators for some time, so he probably got his inspiration from that. Yeah, you wouldn't want to come out the London Underground on stairs, would you?
Why not?
Because you'd be exhausted by the time you got to the top.
Well, there were some that had stairs, only.
Oh, yeah, I know.
There were others where they had lifts only.
Oh, really?
Well, I think, I say the lifts only and stairs only. They probably had lifts and stairs, but no escalators.
Yeah, I've been in, they're still there without escalators.
Those lifts were very rickety. I don't know whether they must surely have replaced them by now, but they were really bad when I lived there.
Right.
Felt like I was putting my life at risk.
Because you probably were.
It's interesting that climate change came up again in the context of sci-fi, and particularly Phil's reference to Asimov's adoption of psychohistory and predictive psychology. Could these tools help humanity tackle climate change and other problems on the basis of what can be predicted from previous behaviour? Phil didn't feel up to going into detail, but psychohistory exists as a synthesis of psychology, history, social sciences, and the humanities. Critics have called it pseudoscience, but it may just be helpful in understanding humanity's predilection for self-destruction and how to counter it. We turn now to Phil's perspectives on death, based on his Christian beliefs.
Taking the Christianity thing, you know, it's all God's fault. He could have stepped in and stopped all this. But then again, why should he? You know, we all live in a fallen world, and this is part of what it was all about in the beginning. Him saying, you know, you wanted to be in charge of everything, so go for it. It's what you'd say for it to a child, really. You know, if a child keeps on wanting to do something, you say, right, well, okay, so be it, and you deal with the consequences. So, why not me?
Well, some people would look at it, what have you done to deserve it, compared to other people who have done something to deserve it, but nobody deserves it.
Well, the argument would be, in Christianity, everybody deserves it. Mm. So there.
So why does Christianity say everybody deserves it?
Because of the Adam and Eve and eating from the tree of knowledge and disobedience, and basically that's what created the world to change from a perfect garden with a perfect life to one that was tainted, where, you know, Adam was, you know, they were saying, well, we're all naked, and he said, well, who told you that? He said, right, if that's the way you want to play it, then okay, you can be in charge of this. You can know good and evil, and you can deal with the consequences of it. And that's how it all started. What's it called? Well, it's called the fall, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We all suffer from that. The only difference is that, you know, Christians would say that Jesus died for us so that we're saved anyway, and through his grace. And grace, as opposed to, because grace is something that is given, not something that you can, it's not an entitlement. So you can't feel entitled that you can end up in heaven and everything, but it's something that can be given to you. And if you believe in Jesus, then it will be given to you.
Mm.
You know, when it comes down to it, it doesn't really matter that I'm ill, because it's just a transition.
A process that getting through.
Yeah.
So you believe in something beyond death?
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Don't believe in reincarnation like Buddhists.
Mm. That must be reassuring.
To a point. Yes, to a point.
Would you rather it not be happening right now?
Well, there's never a good time for it. So, yes. But then I'm thinking, if I had to go through this when I was 70 or 80 or 90, it would be pretty bloody miserable.
Yeah, I wouldn't, yeah.
But probably quite quick, so perhaps not so bad.
I think our dad went in a shocking way, but actually he didn't suffer.
No, well, not for long.
Mm. Well, I don't think he probably didn't really know what was happening to him, did he?
No. One minute he was speaking, trying to reassure me that he was all right, and the next minute he was silent, and that was it. Whilst they were carrying him out of the ambulance, they realised that he was in the process of dying. He was certainly unconscious by then.
I didn't want us to go into this sort of...
Christianity.
No, I don't mind that. It's I just don't want you to be... Mm. This is quite a topic to be talking about, really, isn't it?
But it's change.
It's change.
Mm.
I think, basically, I don't want to upset you.
Right. I'll try not to be upset.
Well, you don't have to try. I mean, if you are upset, then you don't have to hide it from us.
I'll try to be upset.
No, no, no.
Oh,
yeah. Just be yeah. How you want to be.
Fine.
Yeah.
Right, I'll try and be what I want to be.
What do you want to be?
Well, I'd like to be a singer, but I can't. So that's a bit tough.
Regardless of your beliefs or absence of them, I think there's something that we can all relate to in that last section of the discussion. But I cringe now at the clumsy comments I made to Phil in an effort to avoid upsetting him. Probably wrongly, I'd wanted to avoid talking about subjects that would stir his raw emotions. But I didn't want to stifle him in expressing his feelings either. It's common to suggest that men have difficulties in sharing their feelings with others. Looking back through the 60 years of our times together, I certainly wish that Phil and I had shared more of our feelings. Thankfully, in the podcast discussion, brotherly love and Phil's generous humour overcame my clumsiness. It's time to lighten the mood before this episode nears its end. You're about to hear a clip that finds Phil talking with his son Josh about the funny side of being stuck in a hospital ward with no windows and no visitors allowed.
We're going to talk about my favourite ceiling tile.
Yeah.
I haven't got one. I was having a blood transfusion at the time and Uncle Rob was phoning me up about a podcast about talking about change. And it was all about, you know, where did I see myself in the last 25 years or where do I see myself in the next five or something like that. And I thought, this sounds like a job interview. I said, why don't you ask me what my favourite ceiling tile was? Because I was lying on my back having a blood transfusion, just looking up at ceiling tiles, thinking, well, they've been fitted quite well, actually. And I quite like the ones where they put the lights recessed, things like that. And I was thinking, that would cover a couple of seconds. And then, of course, there was the ceiling tiles in Ward 2, where they'd got lights behind pictures of tropical scenes.
Oh, like in The Dentist?
Yeah, like in The Dentist. Yeah, very like The Dentist. And then they'd turn them on at random points of the night, so you'd suddenly say, bing, it's dawn. And you're thinking, what time is this? And you think, it's 4 o'clock in the bloody morning. And then, will you turn your lights off? And all these things would go on. I'm sure Ward 2 was some sort of torture chamber. I'm sure I'd done something really bad to end up in Ward 2. Messing with your body, messing with your clock. Bing! Lights would come on. And for the rest of the day, it'd be early evening. So that was why that question was on there. My favourite ceiling tile. So I suppose it was almost my least favourite ceiling tile.
That's not quite gallows humour, but it's certainly Phil making us laugh with him at an unpleasant experience. It says a lot that he tried very hard and succeeded in avoiding the need to stay in that particular hospital again. I hope that this episode, along with episode 1, has succeeded in giving you a snapshot, or should I say, a series of sound bites illustrating the changes experienced by one person and the society around him over the last 50 or so years. It's also a warm, humorous and thoughtful insight into the mind and character of my brother. If you knew Phil, I hope that hearing him has touched you again with his thoughtfulness, intellect and humour. Let's all treasure him in our hearts. For those listeners who never met him, I hope you've grasped an essence of him through these two episodes, as well as being provoked to think about our constantly changing lives. I carried out most of the post-production of these two first episodes of Time is Sliding several months after Phil died at home on the 24th of October 2020, with his family around him. He'd been released from hospital 4 days earlier, after medical staff said there was nothing more they could do for him. Because of the pandemic, only 30 people were allowed to attend Phil's funeral, and so it was made available via YouTube for the many friends, relatives and former colleagues who were unable to attend from around the world. This is a relatively small but emotionally charged example of why 2020 will be remembered as the year when enormous and sudden changes were precipitated by the human folly of exploiting our animal kin. That's almost it for the second episode of the Time is Sliding podcast, featuring a discussion about change with Phil Bayliss, my brother. Thanks to everyone listening. A very special thanks to Phil, wherever you are. You've continued to make me laugh in producing this precious podcast, but your physical absence hurts a lot. So I'm going to say it one more time.
Thank you very much indeed for being my guest on my podcast.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I just wish I'd felt a bit better.
So do I. I think you've been good.
Thank you.
It's certainly been a pleasure for me. In producing this podcast, I've listened to Phil's voice so much that it's kept him alive for me. That might be why there are very few moments in episodes 1 and 2 when my own emotions have got the better of me. It may also explain why it still seems unreal that I shall never be able to spend any more time with Phil in person. The episode included contributions from our mother, Phil's wife Jane, and his son Josh. Thanks to them too. I shaped the discussion with Phil around change, and he bought into that. In episode 1, we covered changes imposed by illness, along with changes in attitudes, technologies, behaviour, music, entertainment, punishment, choices, and the environment. In episode 2, we've discussed change through the lens of time travelling into the past and into the future, science fiction, and a Christian perspective on death. I put some further information and links in the episode notes. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to it, if you haven't already done that. Please also give it a good rating and a review if you wish. In that review, you could give your ideas as to what life might be like in 2050. What do you think may have changed to deliver a livable future for the generations that follow you and me? If not in a review, why not share your ideas via Twitter and copy to @timeissliding, that's all one word, with the T and the second S as capitals. I'll end with two quotes. The first is attributed to Eckhart Tolle, author of The Power of Now. I think it's very relevant to the fact that Phil accepted his predicament. To complain is always non-acceptance of what is. It invariably carries an unconscious negative charge. When you complain, you make yourself into a victim. When you speak out, you are in your power. So, change the situation by taking action or by speaking out if necessary or possible. Leave the situation or accept it. All else is madness. My second quote is from Steve Jobs, founder of Apple. He died in 2011 from cancer at the age of 56. In 2005, he gave a moving address at Stanford University after surgery. Here's an extract, but it's well worth reading or listening to the whole speech. There's a link in the episode notes. This is what he said. For the past 33 years, I've looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? Whenever the answer has been no, for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. I'm Rob Bayliss. For better or worse, all production work has been by me. Any extraneous noises and background chatter you heard was because of the rustic way the recording had to be made. Bye for now, and toodle pip for those over a certain age who've resisted change. Watch out for the next episode of Time is Sliding. My guest will be the inspirational activist, dreamer, death doula, chairperson of Incredible Edible Todmorden, Mary Clear. The episode will appear in your podcast feed in a month's time if you're a subscriber. Now, I'm off to steam clean my ears and stimulate my hands and feet in Peter Gabriel's Steam. Phil introduced me to that song while he was ill in 2020. I'm not a Peter Gabriel fan as such, but his song Sledgehammer always gets me moving, and so Phil thought I would like Steam too. He was absolutely right, but I now dance to it with tears in my eyes. Thanks again for the recommendation, Phil. Yet another way, I owe you. Never let's live by you.